When is the best time to support Major Spoilers? Not when it's too late. Become a patron today and join the ranks of fine patrons like Sarah Gray,
Ryan Venice,
Jamie Lockhart,
and Matthew Bach. Thank you so much for your support. This episode is for you, and you can find out how you can get a show dedicated to you at patreon.com/majorspoilers.
The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Ashley.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, we welcome October with the spooky doings of Werewolf by Night. Plus, costume fun starts early with Batman in the Shadow. Weirdness is afoot with Dastardly and Muttley, and Rodrigo catches both the pigeon and one of those pomegranates that freaks everything out. Plus, the kick butt poll of the week. News you can use with your shoes to recuse, and the Mighty Major Spoilers crews making copies. So do that thing you do that breaks my heart in two, according to the O'Neaters, because the Major Spoilers podcast is on the air.
Welcome to issue 748 of the Major Spoilers podcast. Thank you so much for downloading, sharing this episode with a friend, and really, thank you to everyone who's spreading the words. Those of you who are on Twitter saying, hey, I love listening to the Major Spoilers podcast and the Critical Hit podcast and Top 5 and Zach on Film and all the other shows that we do. Thank you so much for spreading the word, because we really need to get the word out. And I think we do a pretty good show, and we've got some pretty good people here to put that show together. And I think if we had even more people listening to the show, we could have even more fun. So how about that?
Nice.
Get out there. Spread the good word.
How's about it, yo?
How's about it, yo? How's about the news, yo? Action Labs yanks the pervy cover over controversy. Wizard World changes the convention schedule for 2018. And Saturn Girl heads to the Supergirl television show.
The Wheel of Destiny is broken, so this week we're going to be using the Planetary Chance Machine.
Oh, no. Giant ball is gonna spin out, and it's going to hit Ashley on the head. Ashley, you're the next person to go into space with Saturn Girl as she heads to TV's Supergirl this season. Now, this was news that came out about a week or so ago that has a certain Imra. What's her last name? All I know is her is Imra. Matthew.
Rabinowitz.
Imra. Sorry, Rabinowitz.
I was kissing people goodnight. Imra Ardeen. Ardeen Rands of Titan.
Spoilers.
Of Saturn.
Spoilers for those of you who are listening to our
spoilers
other podcast,
from 1977,
the Legion
literally
Clubhouse
before
podcast.
Half of these people are born. Raise your hand if you were born
Legion,
before 1977.
Legion of Superheroes is something that I love, something that Matthew loves. And last year, well, really ever since the CW universe kicked off, we'd have these subtle hints of the Legion of Superheroes. We've seen the Legion flight ring appear when Flash is running through the multiverse. We've seen Mon-El show up this last season as a love interest to Supergirl. And now Amy Jackson will play Saturn Girl in an upcoming episode. And I don't know if it's a recurring role or if it's a one-shot thing. But hey, look, Ashley, more Legion of Superheroes on our CWs.
Cool. Hopefully it means less Mon-El too.
Hey.
Maybe he'll die and she'll have to come back and say, oh, look, he died. How sad. Not.
He'll probably get stuck in the Phantom Zone due to lead poisoning for 1,000 years.
For 1,000 years. Interestingly.
And this happens in the comics.
In the comics, Saturn Girl is one of the ones that created the antidote for Mon-El to come
the
out.
The syrup. The serum 0Z6XY. That's too thick. Even I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm sorry. Let me do that over. 3, 2, 1. The serum.
The serum. That's right. The now, serum. Legion of Superheroes had their own cartoon show, what, like 5 years ago, it seems like? Maybe longer?
2006.
Wow.
Ten
so
years
10 years ago.
Ago.
Really? 10 years. Holy cow.
If anyone wants to watch it,
it's actually
such a good show.
If you want the best take on Bouncing Boy, the best take on Triplicate Girl, and a take on Timberwolf, that is definitely your cartoon.
Yeah. She
of
also,
all the Timberwolf stories ever made, that is one of them.
Saturn Girl also appeared in the Smallville series in season
once,
8.
Yeah.
Just once. It was a really kind of weird episode. I kind of hope she has a more comics-oriented costume in Supergirl.
I loved that leather Saturn Girl outfit. I felt like it was really well done for that Smallville aesthetic where everybody just has a color-coded hoodie that resembles their superhero costume.
I guess.
Which is only disturbing when they did it with Cyborg, for God's sake.
Yeah.
What's his power? His body is made of metal. Let's give him a silver hoodie. We're on a budget.
Are you a Legion of Superheroes fan, Ashley?
Yeah, I've read Legion Lost.
Nice. That's a good story.
It is.
Oliver Quaffell.
It is a good story. So I always keep hoping that Monstress is going to show up, and she never shows up in anything. And
oh, poor Monstress. Monstress is one of probably the most tragic Legion stories, just in terms of how they screwed her up.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
Rodrigo, we're not getting Gates yet.
Right.
But I wonder, if we are not, again, I keep saying, the best CW show. I mean, if Riverdale is as popular as it is, imagine putting Riverdale in space with a little bit of happiness, and that's the Legion of Superheroes. So I'm wondering, Rodrigo, are we still being teased with a future Legion of Superheroes television series?
I mean, this could, you know, be the beginnings of a potential future pilot. You know, it happens all the time. If, you know, they've now introduced two potential Legion people, right?
Yeah.
So
I think it's actually three. Well, yeah, no, I guess Wynn's girlfriend is from Starhaven, which is Dawnstar's home planet, but she is not herself Dawnstar.
Right. So, you know, if it catches on and they get a budget that can accommodate that sort of thing, you know, they can probably get away with it. I mean, if you consider something, a show like The Flash, you know, where the majority of The Flash is shot inside the lab, you know, and it's like, and then they're like, run The Flash. And then the rest of the show is shot against the green screen of The Flash running. It's like, is it really that big of a difference between the majority of the show shot inside a spaceship and then against a green screen of characters flying and then, you know, fighting a monster out in a, you know, a dark street,
you know,
or something like that. You know, you can do it, especially if you establish that in the far flung future, people, you know, like your threats largely look like people, you know, your,
right. You're aliens.
Your aliens are
more Drews.
Yeah, your more Drews and Emerald Empresses and stuff are largely going to look like humans. You can do it with a budget.
If you use the aesthetic of the Legion of Superheroes from even the Archie Legion, $3 million can go a long way, especially if you make your first season villain the Time Trapper. All you have to do is go down to the Halloween store and grab a black or purple robe and throw that on, and there you go.
That would definitely make it the most expensive CW show if it was at $3 million.
That's true. But this is the thing, though. The Flash and Supergirl.
And for the whole season there, actually.
Well, yeah.
Oh, well, if you make it for the whole season, they'd greenlight that so fast.
Legends of Tomorrow is actually a literal superhero team. But if you watch The Flash and Supergirl, there's like 20 recurring regular characters on these friggin' shows.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have episodes
The Flash.
Right. The Flash has long stretches where all of a sudden Draco Malfoy is gone. Oh, Draco's in England. You know, and you could do that, but instead of having him have to be Draco Malfoy the jerk, you have him be Gates as voiced by Gilbert Gottfried. And instead of having, you know, Caitlin, the lab girl who is there to fall in love with the villain and also cry about her dead fiancés, have her actually be Dawnstar, having the same issues or power problems or attitude issues, and, you know, draw wings on her back.
Well, I mean, we've seen what they can do with Armie Hammer as the Winklevosses.
The Winklevosses?
Yes, the Winklevosses.
That are Winklevosses.
I mean, Triplicate Girl would be a no-brainer. I really think you and I have talked about this on Legion Clubhouse, Matthew, is that one of the neat things that they do in the comics, especially in the early days, is, hey, we're only sending four of you out on a mission. The rest of you are going to be off doing something else, banging your head against the Iron Curtain of Time or something. We don't even have to see
further.
You.
Furthermore, I mean, you could write it differently, right? We've seen, and in plenty of TV shows, we've seen things where you do a concurrent episode, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, oh no, two things are happening at once. Let's send three people to do this, and let's send four people to do that. And then episode 101, 202 is this group. Episode 203 is this group. And then the next episode, they get back together and they compare notes or whatever. And you can have cute little moments in between where it's like, they're like, oh, good thing that we've gotten this taken care of. Then you hear an explosion in the distance and you don't know what happened over there until next episode, where you realize that Bouncing Boy didn't quite manage to bounce that that tank quite right.
Yeah, and you got your entire teenage romance drama, because you can have a whole arc where Night Girl's doing her creepy stalker thing.
Well, right. And the other thing about the Legion is that you actually have tons of material to choose from. You have some Legionnaires that are really wacky, like Gates, like Quizlet, like Monstra. Well, maybe not like Monstra. You can do Monstras, but like Telos. But you have a lot of Legionnaires that just look like people, and their powers are pretty doable.
Sure.
It's like
a lot of fish wire and somebody flying a cape up in the air, and you've got most of their powers.
I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, how it like people have been doing for as long as there has been film, people have been doing, oh, look at this giant. Oh, look at this tiny person.
Yep.
You know?
Right.
Yep.
And they can afford to give us 3 shots of Firestorm every season of Legion of Tomorrow, which means that Wildfire should be doable, because he only has to be on fire part of the time.
Yep.
Yep.
Man, I'm kind of excited about this. I may actually watch Supergirl this season because of this.
Supergirl is strong.
I know it's really good, but I know that first episode or two of this last season was, in my mind, not super strong. And it may have been because of how the first season ended. I was just okay not watching it. And the same way with Legion of Tomorrow. Legends of Tomorrow.
See, this is the problem I have, though. The Berlanti production schedule basically means that every other season of every show they've made so far has sucked. Which means that season 2 of Supergirl was pretty good, which means season 3 is probably going to go straight in the toilet, which frightens me. But you know how you do Triplicate Girl?
How?
You hire triplets.
Ashley Kate Olsen, whatever her name is.
You really don't even need to. I mean, Orphan Black does like 10
duo damsel
people.
Yeah.
That woman
is actually dodecaplets. There's 12 of her.
Oh,
and they
claim
that there's only one, but they pay her like $11 million and split it 10 ways.
Bottom line for me is I approve of Saturn Girl heading to Supergirl's TV show, and I hope that means more Legion. On the way, get busy, CW. Anyone else have any thoughts? Final thoughts.
This actress is beautiful. She is utterly gorgeous. Will she be blonde?
Doesn't matter. I don't know.
Yes, my final thought on this is that they are doing it backwards. They should can the Justice League and do Legion as a movie, because the Legion could use the budget, This is stupid. Their whole Justice League thing is dumb.
If it doesn't have Batman, they're not going to make a movie.
Yeah. Batman actually went to the future with the Legion of Superheroes once.
It has to be Batman adjacent, and it has to have blood flooding chest cavity. Must climb higher. That is what they do.
Ashley, final thoughts on this?
Anything that reduces Mon-El on screen in Supergirl, I am in favor of.
All right, cool. Somebody,
you'd love him if he wore his narrow jacket.
I would
love him if he didn't open his mouth and he didn't try to act.
He just stood
in
the corner.
10 out of 10, best character on the show.
I have heard, Ashley Victoria Robinson, that you may have seen the premiere episode of next week's Flash.
That is 100% true.
Oh, I hate you so much.
Yeah,
but
I know.
Here's the good thing.
I don't hate.
Here's the good thing. Next week, Matthew and I will get to watch the new season of Flash, and then we'll get to talk about it on the Flashback podcast.
Yeah,
coming back for its fourth season
now.
I'm
legit excited for that, because I love that show.
Oh, man.
Season 3, I believe, of Flash.
Oh, is it season 3? No,
we
season 4.
We started Flashback in the middle of season 1.
This is season 4
of The Flash, but season 3.5.
Well, season 1 of Flash does predate us, but season 1 of Flashback would be... Yeah.
About halfway through season 1, we started doing the Flashback podcast. I cannot wait to start talking about everything that's going on, the connections to the comic book world and all that other stuff. And there's only one way that our cool listeners can get their earbuds or AirPods or whatever you're putting in your ears to listen to these shows.
Your pod buds.
only place you can get it is by heading over to patreon.com/majorspoilers and signing up. I think it's the $5 and higher level that will get you an entire season's worth of Flashback. In fact, sign up at the $5 level now and you can listen to all of our previous Flashback episodes and get geared up for next week. I'm not sure you have enough time between now and next week to listen to them all,
but you
can try. But it's always a fun conversation. It's always an interesting discussion, not only about the story, but the comic book roots, Matthew's views on people's acting. All that stuff can be found in the Flashback podcast coming next week. Patreon.com/majorspoilers.
I love Jesse L. Martin.
Yes.
Jesse L. Martin he's one of the best. An angel.
Me
he is perfect
too.
And wonderful.
Yes. Rodrigo,
and
why not?
Iris is also on the show.
Rodrigo, why don't we jump into some reviews and start with you and your take on Fruit Ninja number 2.
Fruit Ninja number 2.
Yummy, yummy.
Did you guys know that they make Fruit Ninja comics?
I did not for some reason. And for some reason, I don't think they sent us a preview. You know, usually on Tuesdays, we run the previews from most of the publishers.
Yeah, I was looking for it.
And they sent us the sneak peek of it, but they didn't send us, you know, they sent us a review copy, but they did not send us the preview pages.
Yeah, I was looking for it on the site, and I didn't see it because I was looking for the solicitation, and I don't know if they sent it to us. But they sent us the preview issue, so I read it, and it is weird.
Oh.
As you might expect from a Fruit Ninja comic, this is Fruit Ninja number 2, so I don't know if I've missed a lot from the first issue. It appears to be kind of an anthology book, and it kind of hops back and forth between the ancient times of Fruit Ninjas and modern Fruit Ninjas. It seems that ancient Fruit Ninjas really concern themselves with attacking with fruit, whereas modern Fruit Ninjas concern themselves with wearing fruit so as to draw upon the power of fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Like Kamen Rider Gaim.
Kind of, yeah. So there's that going on. Also, a pleasant surprise, sort of. There is like 2 pages in, it's like, here's a story about ancient Fruit Ninjas. And then, suddenly, the art style changes radically and it's a story. It's like a guy with a jetpack and is like, this guy is in his study and he's like thinking is like, I need to combat evil, but what should I do? It's like, I need like. Evil is cowardly and superstitious. And then like his window breaks and it's like a jetpack flies through and he's like, oh yes, I know. And then he's like a jetpack man. And then it's like a jetpack joyride because it's a half brick property, right? Same thing as Fruit Ninja.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And then that whole thing gets abandoned immediately. And then it's like a Barry Steak Fries feature. Barry Steak Fries being the main character of Jetpack Joyride, whose whole thing is that is this like evil lab that uses him for his experiments, or that he used to work for them, I think, maybe. And now his like sole purpose in life is to cause property damage for them. So he's flying around with his jetpack and he's trying to destroy this like this sort of like deep sea platform or this like out in the ocean platform for them with a hammer. And then he does, and then that's it. And then we go to the present day Fruit Ninjas who are at a rodeo. It's a weird book.
Sounds like it's totally up kids' alley though.
It really is. So there's a lot going on, and there doesn't really seem to be a lot of continuity or anything like that. Although, again, I didn't read the first issue, so maybe the first issue sets up a lot of what is, you know, maybe part of why I was having trouble following it is because, you know, the first issue is like, okay, there's going to be, in every issue, there's going to be an ancient Fruit Ninja, a berry feature, and like a modern Fruit Ninja feature. And that's why I was like, why does this keep hopping around like this? So, you know, maybe that's why I was lost. So altogether, I'll give it 2 slices of meatloaf. It I think it's three separate artists or two separate artists. One for the berry stuff and one for the fruit ninja stuff, but the art was fine. I didn't have any issues with it. It's all like very bright and colorful and, mostly made me want to play, Fruit Ninja and, Jetpack Joyride.
They got
so
you.
I guess it, yeah, I know they did, but I've already gotten those games. So, maybe they should have a backup feature about that. You know, that one where like Barry travels in time and he's like riding around on a zombie dinosaur. I don't remember what that one's called.
Zombie dinosaur.
Yeah, zombie dinosaur. Sure. Let's go with that.
Yeah, maybe.
Zombosaur.
Cool. Fruit Ninja number two. The reason why I didn't get a preview this week is because it actually comes out next week. So be on the lookout for that next week from Dynamite Entertainment. Oh boy, look, we've got all D publishers this week.
D.
Well, you've got DC with Dastardly and Muttley number two, Matthew. Why don't you share your review?
Okay, so back in the 60s, there was this cartoon. And this cartoon was about these guys in a race. And it was the Wacky Races, and it was nuts. But it was wonderful nuts. And so, being as it is a Hanna-Barbera property from the 60s, it is now under the stable of DC, who I think owns everything. They just optioned the rights to my underpants. You'll be seeing that on the CW next fall. But Dastardly and Muttley number two, I'm sad that I missed number one, came out. And this is the thing. Remember, I talked about that cool, cute comedy cartoon. This is written by Garth Ennis, y'all. This is Garth Ennis doing a Garth Ennis almost quasi-war story, only Dastardly and Muttley. So at some point...
It's interesting because Garth Ennis does that whole war series for, I think, Dynamite.
Yeah, he does a bunch of stuff. I mean, The Boys was tangential to that. He did The Night Witches. He did, I think he did a run with for Marvel Max of Phantom Eagle, which was World War One fighter pilot war stuff.
He does a series called Tanks, and I forget what the other one is for Dynamite.
Yeah. And it's all really cool, interesting stuff. Well, apparently, last episode, these two, Captain Mueller and Captain Atcherly, not Dastardly, got involved into some weirdness, and Captain Mueller got transformed into a dog, or at least has the head of a dog. And as this issue starts, he's trying to break Atcherly out, and suddenly they're attacked by a man with a gun that literally looks like it's out of a cartoon and blows complete cartoon holes in people. Doesn't kill them, it just blows cartoon holes in them like they had an encounter with Elmer Fudd. And Dastardly and Muttley, or Atcherly and Mueller, take it on the run to try and figure out what's going on. And as the story goes on, they try and get their act together, and they realize that they're actually both different, because Atcherly is now talking like a cartoon villain. "You juddering dunderhead!" You know, he sounds like Mum-Ra or Cobra Commander or whatever. And as they're trying to figure this out, we actually discover that this is more widespread than we think. There is a moment late in the book where we go live to a press conference from the White House, where the President of the United States is giving a statement, during which he pulls a cartoon hammer out of his back pocket and brains his chief of staff with it, which is kind of interesting. There's also what I'm almost certain is a cameo appearance by Jabberjaw in this issue. I'm hoping that that comes back around and does something. This is weird. I mean, this is really, really weird, because it's that Garth Ennis kind of snarky meta storytelling with this underlying aspect of cartoon physics. And that just gives it enough of an edge to make me think that something really weird is going on. Also, a guy yells at somebody so long that he manages to reach his hand through the telephone and punch him in the face 5,000 miles away. So that's pretty cool. I'm not sure I recommend this, but it is a reading experience, and it's something that I want to know. I want to know where it's going, because in the parlance of the time, as the kids today say, this thing is either genius or cheese sandwich, but I don't know which, and I want to know which. 2.5 slices of meatloaf for Dastardly and Muttley number two, in that it's fascinating and off-putting all at once. And I think that if it is just a six-issue series, I think that it can really kind of get into some things. I will say that I'm both relieved and a little bit sad that the president of the United States was not the actual sitting president of the United States, because I understand that that would be probably a yard too far for DC, but it would also make for a very interesting image with the big orange cartoon hammer. So, you know, you take the good, you take the bad, you take them both, and then you have a sitcom in 1984. 2.5 slices of meatloaf for Dastardly and Muttley, number two.
Very cool, very cool. Lots of interesting comics coming out this week featuring some crossovers, including, I kind of want to read this, Ashley, Harley and Ivy Meet Betty and Veronica, number one from DC Comics.
Heck yeah.
Do they kiss?
Harley and Ivy or Betty and Veronica?
Any? Pick one.
Yes. Not on the lips, unfortunately. Okay. Harley and Ivy and Betty and Veronica is awesome because it's two comic book companies that I like playing in each other's sandbox. And this first issue, which is cool because I thought this was going to be a one-shot, just like those like Elmer Fudd's and Batman's that came out a little while ago that everyone liked. Mm-hmm. But it's a number one, meaning that there's going to be more than number one. I think there's going to be four. Is an examination of two different kinds of female relationships. And the ones who are supposed to be the crazy, bad, evil people are actually the really nice, emotionally supportive, I will help you get what you want people. And the ones who are supposed to be nice, golly gee, wasn't the 50s really good, where all American girls are not nice to each other. So I sort of like them as foils and then as literary foils to each other. It's a really funny issue, which is pretty much all it has to be. There is both written jokes and good visual jokes. I will spoil the issue, like any good Archie comic issue, culminates in a Halloween party dance. And so, of course, there is a significant sequence wherein Betty and Veronica must decide what they will wear to said dance. And we do see them in a montage wearing spy versus spy, which is really pretty cool. But what they decide on is more in line with the DC Comics part of this crossover than not. They haven't come to a head by the end of this issue, but basically Mr. Hiram Lodge of Lodge Industries wants to build a shopping mall / university over Sweetwater Swamp. Nice Riverdale shout out there. And Ivy doesn't want all the beautiful green things to be killed. And that's going to be the conflict of the series. But this is a really, really great issue. Laura Braga, who you may know if you read the Bombshell Digital First series, her art is good. It's good. It struggles with deciding if they're going to draw Betty and Veronica like Camila Mendes and Lily Reinhart. And I just think that they don't have to. And it would be better if we didn't have that sort of uncanny valley effect going on, but I get it because those are characters. It's tough. It's a tough thing to try and balance. But the book lives up to everything it has to. It's written by Mark Andreyko and Paul Dini, who have worked on these characters and other iconic female characters for a long time. So that's great. So if you're looking for a fun crossover that you didn't know you were going to need, this is a great one. There's a ton of Easter eggs. And, you know, who doesn't want to see a bunch of characters dressed up as other characters in the title? I know I definitely did. Comes out on Wednesday, so definitely pick it up.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely going to check that out. I've also got a book from a deep publisher, also from Dynamite Entertainment. This week, it's The Shadow Batman number one. Now, DC Comics just wrapped up the Batman Shadow series, and now it's Dynamite's turn to get in on the action with writer Steve Orlando and artist Giovanni Timpano. And the art in this is really, really good. Steve Orlando's writing is really, really good. Only problem is, I don't like Professor Pig, and I don't like anything that Professor Pig brings to the story. And this starts out with Professor Pig doing some New Year's Eve attack on New York City, with all of his Dolutrons trying to mask the citizenry to turn them into mindless slaves. And of course, Batman shows up and he starts to get overwhelmed. But fortunately, Damian shows up at two, and there's a lot of back and forth between father
and
son.
Would you say fortunately?
I don't know, because I'm not a big fan of Damian either. So that's the other problem I have with this series, especially when there is a lot of back and forth between Damien is my son, and he must be doing what I tells him to do, or else he's going to get the back of my hand. And Damien, meanwhile, is like, listen, old man, I'm going to go to New York and I'm going to do whatever I want in my own hidden lair. So there, meh. And then the Shadow goes to check out Professor Pig's mind and finds out there's some secret organization trying to do something evil in the world. At which point, Damien tries to blow up Batman with a bat grenade. The end. Like I said, I like Steve Orlando's writing. I like the art. I think it's really, really good. I think both of them together are really, really good. This book suffers from two things that I hate the most, Professor Pig and Damien. So I have to bring it down quite a bit from that. I am interested to see if Damien is being controlled by evil forces, which I'm sure he is, and if that's what leads him to try to blow up his old man or not. It's good. It's interesting. It's worth picking out. I think Batman fans and Shadow fans will enjoy this. If you enjoyed the previous series, I definitely think you will enjoy this one. I'm giving this 3.5 slices of meatloaf out of 5. We'll see if Batman returns after this or if Dynamite was able to just finally kill Batman off once and for all and we never have any more Batman anywhere ever, ever again.
I'd be fine with that.
I don't know if everyone else would be. I'm not sure Warner Brothers would be happy with that.
There's like 5 other guys who are going to be Batman. There's Jean-Paul Valley. There's Dick Grayson. There's Barry Allen, who'd be a really fast Batman.
Dick Grayson is busy showing his butt off in his skin-tight Nightwing outfit. So we can't have
Saturn him. Girl. And Saturn Girl could be Batman.
Jean-Paul Valley, you know, I'm sorry if Jason's listening in the background there, Ashley, but never really got into the Jean-Paul Valley, and as Bat's just not a favorite of mine.
Yeah, pretty I agree with that.
Good anyway.
So that really Catman. Only lives
Thomas Blake, the Catman. Could
but
be
see,
Batman.
He's Catman, and he's always complaining about Batman eating burritos. So I don't think he could be Batman.
Yeah, but I think the
only person who could really fill Batman's shoes, of course, is Tim Drake, and he's trapped off in Mr. Oz's weird universe thing right now. So
okay, Tim Drake is 15 years old.
No, he's a little bit older than that.
No, Tim Drake is 15 years old.
Doesn't matter. He's the only one that can fill Batman's shoes. I've seen it because I've seen a 15-year-old on Gotham putting on the Batman
Correct.
Costume.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you just use Gotham as an example of good story?
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say it's good. I just said we've seen a 15-year-old as Batman. It's on Gotham, weeknights
is
on Fox.
15
What's
Gotham.
That?
215? Yeah, I don't watch that show.
I don't watch him either. I don't watch
He's
it either.
13.
The kid is like super tall now. He's like taller than the guy who plays Alfred.
It reminds me of when they did
John
that Peter Pan movie and the guy grew in the middle of the movie. So they started shooting him from really high angles. Yeah.
So many reviews, so many great books coming out this week.
Heck yeah.
I took a look at the stuff that's coming out. There's just so much good stuff. A lot of it has to do with the upcoming New York Comic Con, which is taking place this weekend. If you are in New York and you're going to the show, good luck, because that show is sold out as of Monday, all days but Thursday. And I bet those are even sold out as of this recording. It's going to be packed. It's going to be crowded. There's going to be a lot of cool stuff on the show floor. There's going to be news about the Doomsday Clock. There's going to be streaming panels that are going on. And if you look hard enough, you will find one Ashley Victoria Robinson running around the show floor, and you might just be able to get your hands on a copy of Jupiter Jet #1.
That's true. Although I will say at San Diego Comic-Con, we sold out of Jupiter Jet #1's 5 Saturday, and we have the exact same number in New York, but more Geek History Lesson listeners. So get it early.
Get it early. Get it often.
There's a chance that you'll find more than one Ashley Victoria Robinson. It's a ridiculously common name.
Yeah. I think there's only
Thanks,
one Ashley.
Mom and Dad.
I think there's only one Ashley Victoria Robinson, and she's our Ashley Victoria Robinson. And she's going to lead us in a discussion of her favorite thing in the whole wide world, Star Wars, this week on the Major Spoilers Poll of the Week.
I like Star Wars. Week,
oh, I thought it was... Week.
I just don't care for the Han Solo movie.
Oh, okay. All right.
Or any of the standalone movies, or the Obi-Wan movie. But
so, as always, inspired by an email from one of our listeners, this person wants to know, what is the most useful, not the most powerful, but the most useful weapon in the Star Wars universe? So we have, in no particular order, wrist rockets, those things that the Mandalorians wear on their armor. We got boomas, which are those big plasma things that the Gundans, what are they called? Gundans? Those are the giant robot guys. They're the ones that they fling during episode 1 into the robot droid army. You've got your traditional blasters, either on the Imperial side or Han Solo's, T-44 blaster, whatever that is. You've got the lightsaber. You've got a flamethrower. You've got the thermal detonator, the bowcaster, the electrostaff, and the Death Star. What is the most useful weapon in the Star Wars universe, Ashley Victoria Robinson? Go.
Well, you've named a number of things that I don't know what they are. So those ones are out automatically.
Okay.
I would say it's probably the lightsaber, because the lightsaber has a potential to be used as a tool, even though we've never seen it used that way on the Star Wars. You could light a candle with your lightsaber. Mm-hmm. You could cauterize something with your lightsaber. Like, the potential of just the heat and the light possibilities, forget about how easy it is to murderize someone with it, I think are vastly underrepresented and incredibly useful. Plus, you could make it any cool color you want, and you have to build it yourself. So to build it, you have to be good for something. So definitely, yeah. I say a lightsaber.
I like you say it can be used as a tool. Anakin, I told you to give me the Phillips head lightsaber.
Well, Anakin's already a tool, so he doesn't have
exactly. Well played.
Rodrigo, what is the most useful weapon in the Star Wars universe?
The most useful weapon. It is interesting that you say what is the most useful weapon, because in that sense, it could be the Death Star, assuming that you had multiple Death Stars. Because if everybody has
Star. Nine of them. One is called the Death Star. The other one's the second Death Star. One is Starkiller Base. And the other one's going to be Starkiller Base 2.0.
Right.
It's
going to be if the Empire has a Death Star and the Republic or the Rebel Alliance has a Death Star, then there's mutually assured destruction and then there's no more war, right? So then those would be the most useful weapons in the Star Wars universe. At least they would prevent a galaxy-wide conflict in the same scale as the Clone Wars or what we saw in any of the movies. And then Star Wars movies would stop, which, I don't know.
Oh, no, we can never have Star Wars movies start. Rob says lightsaber, not as clumsy or random as a blaster, a weapon for a more civilized age. Doug says a lightsaber. It slices, it dices, it julienne fries. You can cut through an armored bulkhead or a tomato just as easily. But Matthew, are they right? Is the lightsaber the most useful weapon in the Star Wars universe?
No.
Which is it?
Well, hokey religions and ancient weapons are no match for a good blaster at your side. And as someone who worked in television in the 1990s in Kansas, which was technically the 1970s, I have in fact used the Grass Valley 1600 switcher that powered and controlled the Death Star's death weapon. And that thing's a piece of crap, and I wouldn't trust it any further than I could throw it. But for me, when you say useful, I'm thinking useful for what? I don't know what a Booma is. All I know about Boba Fett is that he fell in a hole and died. An electro staff? Who got an electro staff? I don't know what that is.
A lot of the stormtroopers do.
I like Chewie's bowcaster. I really love the moment where Han was like, why have I never shot this? I thought that was cute. But the thing about a lightsaber that the expanded universe beat to death was that you can't just make one and use one. You can't like go and just lightsaber dude, you'll chop your hand off or some crap. You have to be like force sensitive and find the special magical crystals of Kyber and hoobity boobities and flibberty bibberties. And it's like a deep spiritual, you know, soul cleansing quest that you go through to build your freaking lightsaber. And I'm like, I don't have that kind of time. I'm going to do what Han Solo did. I'm going to pick up a blaster that, you know, maybe I found by the side of the road at one point. And I use it for purely defensive purposes and, you know, shooting guys who bonk their heads on doors.
I can see that. And those are, the Death Star is interesting if it wasn't a complete expensive done in one weapon. Right.
Right. It is. It's too much.
Yeah.
It's too much gun for virtually any situation. It's too much. It's a massive destructive force, and its only possible use is ridiculous.
I don't know about kyber crystals, so I don't know if they're just scattered on the beaches everywhere and people can just pick them up and make their lightsabers. So that one seems
kind of
overly complicated.
No, they're pretty much only on on one moon and a couple asteroids, and they have to sing to you, and you have to go get them, and you have to harvest that. Like, it's a thing.
Oh, man. I thought you and my wife was
you
hard.
You have to know all the lyrics of the songs they're singing, and mine was singing Hemorrhage in My Hands by Fuel, and I can't for the life of me understand that second bridge. And I'm like, man, I can't get a kyber crystal and build my lightsaber. Thanks, Fuel.
For me, I just want to push a button, toss it, and be done with all the problems. And that's why I think the thermal detonator is the most useful. It's, you know, you can take out a mess of stormtroopers with it. Just, you know, boom, there you go. If you're into heavy negotiations with one of the huts, all you got to do is pull one out and negotiations over. Right? So for me, I think the thermal detonator is the most useful weapon in the Star Wars universe. It's great for destroying things. It's also great for negotiations and diplomacy. Thermal detonator.
Cowboy diplomacy, maybe.
To be fair, you could take out a whole mess of stormtroopers with a length of pipe and a chain tied to
well,
it.
Well, that's true, too.
That's true.
Notice I didn't put log. Beaten. Log is not on the list.
Right.
Log. It's big, it's heavy, it's wood.
Yeah. But
the thing, though, the stormtroopers were beaten up by the magical teddy bears of Aboriginal 5.
But they had logs, and logs aren't on the list.
See, I agree with Rodrigo. Beating a stormtrooper does not prove usefulness. Beating a stormtrooper proves that you got a pulse.
Yeah, that's the base. That's the very basic level.
Is it a weapon?
Because if we were playing a Star Wars RPG FMK game, like everybody has already like picked what class everybody's playing.
Yeah, I'm a bounty hunter.
Yeah.
Ashley's
like
a Jedi.
Steve's got bounty hunter. No disintegration. Yeah. Yeah. Ashley's Jedi.
I would love to be Jedi.
Rodrigo
I'm a
is
nerf herder.
You're a nerf herder, and Rodrigo is the Empire.
I'm Empire defector. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. There you go, ladies and gentlemen.
This is a good...
Listen, Patreon.com...
Star Wars names again?
Patreon.com/majorspoilers. Come up with our Star Wars names, and maybe we will be playing a Star Wars RPG in the next round of games.
Your first pet and the street you grew up on, right?
Isn't it the first two letters of all your names?
Yeah, it's first two letters of each of your names.
No,
or that's
I'm
how
not
you
first
get
that.
Your YouTube first name.
First syllable of each of your names.
The first syllable of my last name is P. I'm not doing that. Not gonna happen.
Yeah,
well, never gonna happen.
Let's see. We've got lightsaber, blaster, lightsaber, 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 thermal detonator. How has everyone else voted so far in the major spoilers poll of the week, Matthew?
Oh well, as expected, nearly 50% of the vote going to lightsaber, followed closely by blaster at 33% of the vote. That right there literally knocks out most of it. Wrist rocket, Booma, and flamethrower. Who has a flamethrower?
Almost the entire Empire.
Okay. Those have no votes at all. Not a sausage.
Yeah.
No. Bugger all.
Yeah.
7% saying thermal detonator, 9% bowcaster. I'm sorry, what?
You're going to give us an explicit tag.
In Britain?
Where do you think 90% of our audience is at right now?
Oh, those are... Oh, I see the problem. Those are all the guys who voted bowcaster because that means something else in Britain.
Right. 10% voted electrostat.
That means answering machine in Britain. It's like, right. Did you leave a message on the bowcaster?
Oh, man. Here come the emails. Podcast Major Spoilers.
They're
going to
get so many. I'm sorry.
It's always unpleasant when people start making fun of our British accents. I have like 9 of them, and some of them are actually.
Listeners, you can head over
4%
to
4% Death Star.
Listeners, you can head over to the Major Spoilers website. Do it. Do it now. Cast your vote in the Major Spoilers poll of the week. Let us know what is the most useful weapon in the Star Wars universe. I have a feeling we're going to see a lot of these lists pop up as December gets closer and closer. And that
Why?
New Star
What's in
Wars.
December?
Well, there's this new Star Wars movie that's coming out, Matthew. I know you'll wait until like April, May, June next year see it. But a lot of people are going to be geared up for it in December.
In the movie theater.
Did you really?
This will be the fifth one. Yeah.
All right. There you go.
I took Widget to go see the Force Awakens hit snooze and it awakens again 5 minutes later.
Let's talk.
What's this one called?
It's The Last Jedi.
Oh.
But
if only.
But just keep in mind, it's called The Last Jedi, but there is a Star Wars Episode 9 currently in production.
Well, yeah, but it could mean in terms of the last Jedi who come in here, he was real rude and cut the place up with his lightsaber.
It's from the Final Fantasy school of titling. Final Fantasy 14.
Final Fantasy 12 Part 2.
This isn't the Final Fantasy. What? Maybe it'll be Last Jedi 2. The Electric Boogaloo.
Tertiary fantasy just doesn't have the same ring to it.
Oh, Tatooine by day, werewolf by night. That's the discussion this week. On
Amarillo by morning.
Ashley, why did you want to know about Werewolf by Night?
Why?
Yeah.
I've never read it before.
Oh, okay. I thought there may be something coming up in your life.
I was like, I didn't know that I was the one who prompted this. Because I read it, and I don't know if I know what happens in it. I'm not going to lie.
Well, so let's take a look at this stuff. 1971, 1972, Matthew?
Yes.
We're looking at
1972.
Marvel Spotlight number 2.
Yes.
A boy by the name of Jack Russell.
Steven.
Jack Russell is his name. And at the tender age of 18, he turns into a werewolf 3 nights out of every month. Jack Russell is his name.
Okay. We get it. There's a dog by that name. It's probably an intentional pun by Jerry Conway.
Jerry Conway, Mike Ploog, and based on an idea by Roy Thomas.
Oh, well, then the Jack Russell definitely came from Roy.
I'm sure it's Roy.
Nobody loves a reference pun more than Roy.
Here's the crazy thing. For many, 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 many years, you could not publish a werewolf comic. Marv Wolfman couldn't even get his name on the cover of a comic book because his last name was Wolfman. And the comic code authority said no monsters, no werewolves, no mummies, no beheadings, no goofballs. None of that stuff can be inside
Jewish
your comic. Probably that too.
Actually, not the comics code. They were probably mostly Jewish, especially in the day.
Probably.
But Stephen is actually true. The reason that DC actually credited creators in some of their anthology books was because Marv Wolfman's name got them in trouble. And so they had to put his name in a story and it had to say written by Marv Wolfman so that a reference within the story to a Wolfman was actually a reference to Marv and not to a character.
But something happened. Finally, the CCA lightened up a little bit. I think a little bit had to do with Stan Lee going, hey, we don't need you, comic codes authorities. We're going to show Spider-Man dealing with smack. And then suddenly everyone was doing Wolfmans and vampires and Blades by Night comic books.
This actually came out before Stan did the Amazing Spider-Man story. They started revising the code in late 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several revisions through 70-71. That allowed for instance, you could have law enforcement officers portrayed as criminals so long as they got punished at the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could loosen up. They said you could use Draculas and werewolves and things.
Draculas and Frankensteins.
Yeah. Yes. That's exactly what it is, because they had to be references, literary references to those classical traditions.
Which is probably why, number one, we have Jack Russell. Number two, why the Bride of Frankenstein, Quasimodo, and Kraven the Hunter all appear in this book.
Yeah. And this is Jack Russell is at the forefront of a whole wave of monster heroes, because right after Jack, we get Ghost Rider, who's basically a walking skeleton. Dracula in Tomb of Dracula starts a couple years after this. Frankenstein had his own book at Marvel for a while. The monster as hero riff was a big deal at Marvel in the early 70s.
Well, and we also see that come back around right now with Cullen Bunn's Monsters Unleashed.
Yeah.
And now it's not the same universal monster type things, but it's still this whole monsters as hero storyline. Yeah.
And it cycles. I mean, it's the same thing that gave us the Swamp Thing and his identical twin brother with the carrot nose, the Man Thing,
in 1973. The Hulk.
Yeah, the Hulk is actually kind of a precursor to it, that monster as hero thing became Marvel shtick.
Well, so yeah, because
we see a lot of these guys from Marvel in the
70s. The first couple issues of the Hulk, if I'm not mistaken, isn't it at night when he transforms into the Hulk and not when he's angry? And he's got to be locked away by Amadeus Cho there.
Rick Jones.
Oh, I'm sorry, Rick Jones.
He looks super like Solomon Grundy in the beginning, too, when he's all gray.
Yeah.
So, gray with a square head.
So, Ashley, we've kind of touched on Werewolf by Night, 18-year-old gets his birthday and turns into werewolf. What's happening in these two short volumes that we've read?
Would you call them short?
Well, so in the Marvel Spotlight, if I'm not mistaken, was an extra-sized issue stuff because they actually had like two different stories going on in there. And so
Marvel Spotlight was a 36-page book.
So Werewolf by Night runs in Marvel Spotlights in issue 2, 3, and 4. And then it's like, hey, this guy's popular enough. We're going to give him his own title, which then ran for 43 issues until like 1977 or something like that.
Yep.
So fairly popular, but we're really only reading the first three issues in the Marvel Spotlight and then the four issues in the Werewolf by Night. Yeah.
Werewolf by Night. Yeah. Basically, it's arc-y, but not precisely an arc, because they didn't really do arcs in comics in the 70s. But this is relatively close to that modern I'm going to tell a story arc. It's sort of the trade.
I mean, that's very like almost the entire first issue is narrated by Jack Russell, who I guess Wishbone wasn't a thing then. So the joke maybe wasn't as funny. And man, there's so much. You were like this dude's therapist, but it is him telling the story of his father. And the Dracula and how he came to be. Yeah.
My daddy never loved me. Yeah, but he gave me this amazing turtleneck and a shirt that has some sort of Fred Jones kind of cravat thing going on.
Yeah, and my mom married someone else and then I got his last name and these people are going to try to lift my curse. And there's so many words on these pages.
Well, and that's, again, I think sometimes the charm of comics from like the late 60s, early 70s is, mm-hmm. especially more so with Roy Thomas and some of the others, but this giant wall of text, which just inundates you with story. And yes, a lot of times you can skip over a lot of that stuff and just look at the pictures and read some of the dialogue balloons to know what's going on. But here's this guy who suddenly is whisked into this world of monsters and finds he has a long lost barren father who has this curse upon him and people are trying to hunt him down. And there's a mysterious book because his dad was a warlock, and it gets weirder.
He's like, oh, that's where my trust fund came from. How cool.
Yeah, and then his evil stepfather sold his family castle to some schmuck out on an island. And then it turns into like this weird Island of Dr. Moreau / Craven's Last Hunt kind of stuff.
That's a good description of it.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts then after reading this, Ashley, of this Werewolf by Night guy?
I actually think for a werewolf story, I think it's pretty good. And I really like werewolf stories that come out of this era. Me personally, I'm going to make the joke, but it is like, once you wrap your head around it, it's not that bad. The art is awesome. It falls apart, it is a part of the Marvel universe. Like X-Men, I sort of want this to be in its own little monster bubble. Like, Kraven's a pretty good pull this story, but I don't need to know that Spider-Man could come waltzing in at any time. Yeah, you know what I mean?
And I'm saying Kraven the Hunter, really it's Joshua Kane, but I mean it's this guy that's like, I'm tired of hunting all the other animals. There's only one left.
Kraven.
Werewolves, yeah. You know, and it's that kind of thing, but it felt very familiar to me, and that's why I put in my show notes Kraven the Hunter shows up in this because
didn't even remember that he wasn't Kraven the Hunter. So there you go.
Well, so I'm wondering, Rodrigo, does this work as a standalone, or should this be part of the greater Marvel universe where, you know, over in DC, we had, what is it, the Monster Squad or whatever, Matthew, where it's like Frankenstein was working with Sergeant Rock and all these other guys doing stuff.
I can't remember. It was the thing. What was their name?
Yeah, but it's like they had Werewolf Monster and Force. Frankenstein and some other guys.
And Medusa.
Yeah. I forgot Medusa showed up in this, too. So, Rodrigo, should Werewolf by Night be in its own universe, or should it be part of the greater Marvel universe? Obviously, when we talk monsters, Blade should probably be in Werewolf by Night, but, you know, he's hanging out with Morpheus and Spider-Man and all that stuff.
Morbius.
I mean, it really depends how you like to look at it. Obviously, there is room for this weird supernatural stuff in the Marvel universe, right? The Marvel universe tends to be very scientific, like super sciencey, right?
Right.
It's like if you look at all of the super teams in the Marvel universe, they tend to be led by some sort of super science guy, right? Reed Richards or Tony Stark or Hank Pym or all of those guys. But you know, there have always been all of these guys kind of in the background, like in the shadows, your werewolves by night, your Ghost Riders, your Man Things, all of those guys.
Ghost Rider. Yeah.
Your Johnny's Blaze, mm-hmm. your Danny's Catch.
your Toki's Wartooth.
Yeah. Your spirits of no, that actually works. Never mind. your Hobgoblin.
All right.
Your wolves urine.
You know, you do the Marvel Universe has always had this other stuff going on, and sometimes you know it crosses over into your mutant stuff or your superhero stuff. And sometimes it kind of comes to the fore. I remember there's been plenty of like Marvel dark mm-hmm. stuff where, you know, Blade gets a comic and then, yeah, he interacts with Ghost Rider and, you know, they will like pull your spooky guys from the other stuff.
Well, if I'm not mistaken,
Doctor Strange and all the guys that do magic from other teams. You know, Thor will get involved because he's a magic guy sometimes. But, you know, then, you know, the time will pass and all of these guys will just, you know, get sidelined again. I think it's a resource that the Marvel Universe has. And sometimes they go away and sometimes they come back.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, Moon Knight made his debut in Werewolf by Night. Correct, Matthew?
He did. In fact, he was trying to murder Werewolf by Night.
Well, see, there you go. And that's
with his silvery weapons.
And that kind of goes with Blade, too, right? He shows up in Tomb of Dracula, which is a Dracula book, a vampire book. And then Blade's running around. So, I mean, I kind of see where the two bump up against one another. But I think it's kind of scarier if Spider-Man doesn't have to be worried about running into a Frankenstein every 14th issue. And he just has to deal with, I don't know, J. Jonah Jameson's and his bounce checks.
Oh, go ahead.
To some degree, I have to argue against that for two reasons.
I mean, there's a lot of times where it works good. I mean, if you're trying to tell a Halloween Spider-Man story or a Halloween X-Men story, then yeah, I think that kind of stuff works really well.
I think that the Marvel Universe is successful partly because of the verisimilitude and the fact that Spider-Man can walk into a Dracula at any given point. And it's played exactly as dangerous to walk into a Dracula as it is to have, you know, Norman Bates or Osborne or whatever that fool's name is trying to throw you off a bridge and boink your girlfriend. I mean, that's part of the appeal of Marvel Comics in a lot of ways is they do these stories where it's like, okay, you guys, you know, the X-Men, the mutants, and it's a whole metaphor for all this stuff and being left out of society and you're the outcast. Okay, you're in space now.
Yeah.
And you're going to have wacky space adventures and Cannonball's going to be a space guy. And it works. Yeah, it works because you don't get locked into that formula. You don't get locked into Spider-Man is an eternal loser who can never win. Spider-Man can only fight the same 9 people that he fought when he was 16. And if he introduced new guys, well, everyone will hate them and call you terrible things on the internet.
Yeah.
Well, and it's fun for crossover stuff, right? Mm-hmm, so it's like Spider-Man is good at dealing with science freaks rampaging across Midtown, right? Mm-hmm. So when he faces off against some sort of monster, like a vampire or a werewolf or something, and he has to team up with a supernatural guy like Blade because his usual punching it and making fun of it isn't working, then, oh, he has to team up with the X-Men because he can't take on Magneto, or he has to team up with Blade because he can't beat up a vampire or whatever. You know, it's like it actually helps. It actually expands that Marvel universe to show that, or, you know, it's like, hey, Shang-Chi, I can't actually do anything about this. Can you teach me a little bit of Kung Fu so I can actually beat up this dragon?
Right.
Something. I don't know. Right. Yeah. It actually expands the Marvel universe to show you that, you know, part of the problem, I think a lot of the time with why people are like, Superman's stupid, is because Superman is so powerful and so capable and so able to be everywhere at once that it like waters down stories where you should be like, well, where's Superman right now? The Marvel Universe doesn't have that problem because generally speaking, you don't think that Iron Man has to be everywhere at once. Mm-hmm. You don't think that Spider-Man has to be everywhere at once because they don't have that ability. But right. It sure is fun when Spider-Man does, for some reason, end up in Transylvania or, you know, somewhere else, right? Mm-hmm. When you do end up with, like, Shang-Chi and Spider-Man and Blade in the same comic, and you're like, holy crap, what are these three guys going to do?
I think I want to read that.
Exactly.
Ashley, were you here for our Blade discussion? I can't remember. It's such a long time ago.
And awesomely, in our master list, there's a little note that says we did this for Ashley because she never read it.
Okay.
And I was not here for it, unfortunately.
Okay.
But I've also, never read Blade. Seen Blade.
You haven't watched a movie or anything like that?
I've seen a photograph.
Okay.
Of right. Blade.
Of Wesley Snipes with a buzz cut and bangs.
Yeah. I'm dying for them to remake it with the guy who plays Omar from The Wire.
Man, that'd be so good.
Just cut him out of Star Wars, like, he's gotta work.
Mark my words, that is where Netflix should go next.
Oh yeah, totally.
Like, they should put aside this Defender stuff. They have kind of ran it into the ground. If they want to do low budget stuff on Netflix or low-ish budget stuff on Netflix, they need to pursue, you know, spooky Marvel. They need to do Werewolf by Night. They need to do Blade. They need to do that stuff. Go back to your roots, Marvel.
Yeah.
Saving that for the Disney streaming service that's going to yank everything that we love off of Netflix in a year or so.
Yeah.
That's true.
I wonder, Matthew, why Werewolf by Night? What made it end? It's obviously not as popular as Tomb of Dracula or Blade because so few people are super familiar with Werewolf by Night. Is it just a product of it? I mean, no, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about a lot of people.
I was actually arguing about Blade. I think Blade didn't really become a thing until the mid 1990s when they revamped it. But
maybe I remember seeing Blade before I saw Werewolf by Night.
That 90s Spider-Man cartoon, man, it did wonders for Blade.
It did have that, but I'm talking about like black and white Blade stuff, like one of those Marvel bigger issue type things.
Blade was in Vampire Tales a couple of times.
Yeah, so. Maybe that's what it was. But why Werewolf by Night not as popular? I mean, it's got werewolves. It's got this kid running around going, what am I going to do with my life? I'm a vampire. I'm a werewolf
from the movie or the book. He's a new invention and he doesn't have the brand power behind him.
I think there's a couple of things. Part of it is just the proliferation of monster heroes and more interesting monster heroes. I mean, you look at guys like even Tales of the Zombie, which sounds like it should be super, super generic, has a really clear through line and a really strong story about a guy who was a jerk, had to come back to life, and in order to actually rest after dying and being resurrected, has to make up for all the jackwagon things he did.
Mm-hmm.
Other than your dad was a werewolf and now you're a werewolf, there really isn't a solid hook to Jack. And we find, you know, we talked about the Hulk transforming at night. That went away quickly because it wasn't working. It was something that felt kind of constrictive to the stories they wanted to tell. And Werewolf by Night, I don't think it ever really got a solid hook. Jack Russell hurt them.
Well, yeah. I do kind of like the hook of the story that every time you're reading the comic, it happens over the course of 3 days and three nights, right? The time that he's the werewolf. And so he's got a whole other month to move from another state to another city to do whatever he needs to do. So that by the time he gets the weird, wacky adventures, it's werewolf time. It's not one of those things that's like, there's someone over there. I must activate my werewolf powers.
But doesn't it feel like there needs to be something else? Like, either he needs to be freaking out a lot harder.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
He either needs to be freaking out a lot harder, like, oh no, I haven't gotten far away enough from civilization for werewolf time, or, aha, I have finally tracked down this gang of criminals. Now it's werewolf.
Oh, I've got to wait four days, like, before it's werewolf time.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's like, oh no, I've gotten into trouble way too soon.
Yeah.
It's 6 p.m. and it won't be dark for another 3 hours.
And we're not reading all 45 issues. So I don't know if that ever happened. But you're right.
Yeah.
But I kind of like that here's your story. It's taking place over the course of 3 days max. And
right.
That's why he's the werewolf, because Act One sets up the conflict. Act Two, he's getting into all of his troubles. And then in Act Three, he has Kraven the Hunter murdered by a stuffed bear on the wall.
Yeah. Well, the most successful Marvel monster heroes have not just a hook, but multiple hooks. Tomb of Dracula became an ensemble book. And, you know, the titular character is not the hero. He's actually the villain. So you come to a point where that book ended because the ensemble cast of heroes actually stabbed him in the heart and he died. You know, the hook there was, it's not about Dracula. It's about the extraordinary lengths that people go to deal with a monster like Dracula.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
Ghost Rider basically became kind of an allegory for a man fighting his own base instincts. I mean, you can call it a demon in his head, but for all intents and purposes, you could take Johnny Blaze and tell his story, you know, instead of, oh, if I get angry, I turn into a Hulk, or if something happens, I turn into a demon. If I get really, really upset, I hit the donuts really bad. I mean, that's probably a bad example. There are more dramatic ways you can do that.
Yeah.
What,
it is that, right? It's all about your base or instincts, mm-hmm. which Werewolf by Night is, these issues of Werewolf by Night are approaching, but it's not there yet, right?
Yeah,
it's,
I wonder, are they trying to make
these issues are very close. Like, that's why I brought up the Hulk, is because they are that first, they're just so close to that first run of the Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why they're not quite compelling, because there's a reason why they changed the Hulk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like,
that's a good point.
This thing that just happens because of a time of day, is not as compelling as these things that happen for internal reasons. The family drama is compelling,
mm-hmm.
and having to deal with the stuff that's happening because of the time of day is compelling. But the conflict of the monster inside is almost external. It's not something that happens to him because of something that he's doing or because of something that's happening there. So that's what's lacking, right? Which sucks, because it's the character's connection to the book, to the hook, to the story.
Right.
Yeah.
Jack,
so it's just not quite there.
Jack lacks agency,
right?
Especially in later arcs when we get to a point where
Jack Russell.
Yeah, Jack Russell. What he wants is to not be the werewolf, but the reason there's a book is because he is the werewolf, and you have the Gilligan's Island syndrome. Of, you can't make every story about Jack not trying to find a way to not be the werewolf anymore, because at that point you just have to ask yourself, why not just eat Gilligan?
Yeah.
You have that problem where if you resolve the core of the concept, you end the show, and the story can't be about resolving that concept, because at that point when you do it, you're done. If you want this to be an ongoing concern, you needed to have something else. And Jack kind of slid into standard superheroics, fighting guys like Dr. Glitter Knight and fighting Deprave. And he never had a costume. He just had green pants. And he's a brown, hairy guy in green pants. And even on the concept of a monster hero, in a world where turning bright green and having purple stretch slacks from Sears is an iconic look for one of Marvel's superheroes, the green pants on a brown, hairy body just never really clicked, I think, for me visually.
Yeah. So the comic I'm thinking of from DC, Creature Commandos. That's what we were thinking.
Thank you. I was sitting here going, it's not monster.
Yeah.
Stop saying monster, Steven. For God's sake, stop saying monster.
So in summary, Werewolf by Night is interesting. It's missing Warren Zevon. The worst thing about this book is, or about this series that we read is, the gag about hiding the ancient Tome of Evil inside a box of cornflakes.
Yes.
And the other,
hey, it worked.
The other worst thing about this this book is, I don't know. There's something interesting about it, but it's really missing. So if you get a chance for me, if you get a chance to check out Werewolf by Night, I say do it. Read an arc of stuff and see where it goes. But don't expect, this ain't Shakespeare, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh.
Ashley, would you like to give us a summary of your experience with Werewolf by Night?
My experience with Werewolf by Night was that of interested confusion.
Mm.
I think because of the circumstances of the time and because copyrights are a difficult thing to handle from time to time, this book suffers. I think the premise is actually pretty good. There are way worse monster story premises. And even though I fell asleep halfway through, I liked it.
Rodrigo, your thoughts, your final thoughts, please. Werewolf by Night.
I think there's a lot of good stuff here, but basically it is that kind of early Marvel anti-hero stuff, and it I know that I've read some good Werewolf by Night stories, but it hasn't quite found its feet in mm-hmm. these six stories that we read here. They probably come later, and I don't remember which ones they are. So, I would recommend if you want to see where Werewolf by Night started out. But this is definitely not my favorite that I've read of the character.
And Matthew, we're going to wrap it up with you with your final thoughts on Jack Russell. Get it? Jack Stop Russell.
It. Stop it. The thing about Werewolf by Night, and this is actually... this happens a lot in comics. It's got a lot of the right pieces and never quite put them in the right order. Chunks of this book are still canon core Marvel Universe concepts. I mean, last season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was all about the MacGuffin introduced in these issues. The Darkhold makes its first appearance here, and it has become a cornerstone of Marvel's magic properties. And Jack himself is tangential to Blade and tangential to the Midnight Suns and a lot of the weird Marvel stuff. But the concept of werewolf never quite gelled. But I say, if you get a chance to pick up one of these issues, first of all, I recommend getting yourself a reading copy, like a 3.5 or a 4, and just going through it and looking at what is Mike Ploog doing on these pages, because these are gorgeous comics. Mm-hmm. These are,
that's very true.
Amazing, just beautiful comics. And even the things that are weird and garish and freaky are amazing. But Jack has this glorious mullet and 70s sideburns, and the fashions are fascinating. And you see they're like, oh, we're going to go to this castle in the Alps. And Mike is like, okay, all right, I'll draw you a damn castle in the Alps. You know, throughout the whole thing, it's just utter madness what he puts on the page. And even though the story never quite gels together, there's so many wonderful pieces here kind of laying around, and they never quite got that puzzle to lock down to the point where people love it the way they would say, you know, your Tomb of Dracula's or your Ghost Riders or your Swamp Things, which of the same vintage became popular.
I would watch all of those as a Netflix series. Seriously.
What's that?
The Swamp Things, your Tomb of Dracula's, your Blades, your Ghost Riders, yeah. And your
Werewolf
by Night.
Did you watch Swamp Thing on the USA Network when we were kids?
When we were kids, yes, but USA had just started... USA had just started and I didn't have cable. So it was on some kind of a weird syndication thing where it was like on Saturdays after or right before the New Adventures of Superboy, whatever that series was.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you had to catch it at just the right time on Saturdays to see it. But I do remember watching one or two as they premiered live as they first released.
Those were great, but they had a budget of like $19.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so, I think Knight Rider was more interesting at the time. So there you go. All right.
Knight Rider wasn't in syndication.
I don't know, but it was on Fridays. Saturdays, I was busy.
I'll never speak to you again. You have bad enough Knight Rider.
Matthew and I will be back tomorrow on Dueling Review to bring us a review.
Long, silent show, baby. So check in and just listen to 30 minutes of Steven going, hey, what do you think about that?
Also, don't forget, we've got that other show, Legion Clubhouse, that we've been doing. A lot of fun there. This Friday, as we prepare Zach for fatherhood, we continue our horror film festival as we take a look at Halloween, the original. That's this week on Zach on Film. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you, Ashley. And thank you, Rodrigo, for being part of the Major Spoilers podcast this week. It's always so much fun having all of you on the show at the same time. And listeners, thank you for being part of the Major Spoilers experience. We're going to be back next week. And next week, we're talking about the Flintstones, the series that just wrapped up over at DC Comics. This is a Patreon request from one of our patrons to review this. And we're going to do it because we know that you love comics and we do, too. And we will talk with you soon.
Stop talking about comic books or I'll kill you. I don't care if the Hulk could defeat the Man of Steel. I'm gonna rearrange your face if you continue to debate whether Logan's claws could pierce Steve Rogers' shield. I just couldn't care less if they bring back Kraven. Spider-Man's a clone. Stop spending all our cash on back issues of The Flash, or I swear to God you're gonna spend your twilight years alone.
This podcast is copyright 2017 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile Coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.